access to number 26562, Mr. Ken Taylor, Reel 15. Now, you just got to Reykjavik, and you were waiting for the Totten, or was it already there?
No, waiting for the Totten, so we had a sort of, you know, a couple of days before the Totten arrived, I'm not sure, two or three days. And then after the Totten arrived, we were still there for a few days. The two army chaps had travelled up on another ship. Well, that was the two army chaps had come up on another ship because they had all the track vehicles and trailers on. So that was the Totten, had to wait for that. So they come up and then loaded these track vehicles onto the Totten to take or to be taken up. I don't think they come first trip. The Totten might have come back to make two trips. I'm not sure about that. We sailed for Greenland, and just after we got out of Reykjavik Harbour, I always remember this, most of the officers were up on the bridge, and us as well, sort of watching everything as we're going out, and I suppose the Norwegian, who was most probably the first mate of the Totten, comes up to the captain and says, "Sir, the chief cook's got a lady on board." This Norwegian chief cook has smuggled an Icelandic woman aboard. So, quite unperturbed. And I always remember our leader, being a commander in the Navy, looked absolutely horrified. And they took it quite calmly, and they just called the pilot boat over, because we had a pilot taking us out. I called the pilot boat over, and out come the first mate with this woman in his arms. And across the front of this sealer is quite high, you know, the sealers are quite high. And he just threw her onto the deck of the tug, which was about 20 foot down, and she was caught by someone down there. And he turned round and he said, "I think she will make she will earn her passage back to the shore," or something like that. And it was just like nothing happened. And, you know, the naval officer was quite shattered with this, because these were sort of Norwegian seamen. The amazing thing was with the Totten, the captain, we were going into Danmarkshavn, and you get, in the summer, you've got some clear water right by the coast, and then you've got a big ice field away from it, and then clear water again. And this captain, everybody was quite amazed, he steamed the ship up, and he just rammed the ship into the ice. He kept ramming into the ice till it was stuck. Then he went down to his cabin, because he'd been on the bridge for a long time. He went down to his cabin, get his head down, and everybody looked amazed. But in actual fact, what happened was that ice was moving slowly south, and he'd gone north of our destination, rounded into the ice. The ice is bringing the ship back south. He came back after he'd had his sleep, and he was about 70 or 72 years old, this captain. He went up the crow's nest on the mast, and he steered that ship through all the leads in the ice. And when he came out the other side, he was right opposite the entrance to Danmarkshavn. Danmarkshavn, I think it was called, yeah.
And what happened when you got to Danmarkshavn? That's at Greenland, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Greenland. There's a Danish weather station right on the entrance there, and also a Danish army patrol post, because the Danish army patrol the coast up and down there, because it's all Danish territory. And we anchored there, and a lot of our chaps went ashore to the weather station. They were received by the Danes, and a bit of a party went on board there, you see. And then we were up the field, right up to the end of the field, and there was an old trapper's hut, because there's trapper's huts everywhere up the coast of Greenland. They keep them there, and they've always got some food in there in case anybody gets stranded, you see.
And you sailed up the field?
Sailed up the field. And
did the field have a name? Or? It's all right, they can look it up.
Look it up, yeah. It's all in the books. Such a long time since I read the book. It's all in the books.
So up you went the field. And then did you disembark then?
Yeah, and we pitched tents up as well. Like, it's a bit of a shingly beach up, and the moraine up, and there was a bit of a stream coming down, so we could get nice fresh water coming down from the mountains around.
Now, what you were disembarking, but tell me about what kit you were disembarking to, because you mentioned the sledge, an Anderson sledge. What did you have? What dog
well,
or what?
We just went ashore ourselves with the tents. And then once we'd settled in the tents, we made some rafts with oil drums and planks and various elements, started unloading the totten. Had to get all this stuff unloaded. I don't know how many tons of stores, but fantastic. But getting all this stuff unloaded up onto the shore, because from there, the squadron of flying boats came in, and we had to sort of rig buoys out for the flying boats to tie up to, sort of all being done. This is where obviously the seaman side and the merchant navy men come in very handy with the stores and. And in this little hut, there was a couple of huts there, we set up the radio station, and Dixie Dean set that up first. Then they started flying up to the lake. The lake was about 200 miles away, and it was clear of ice.
Flying from where to where?
From this field up to the lake in Queen Louise Land.
So the flying boats carried the gear from there onwards.
You realise when you see that the number of flights they had to make to unload that ship, how much a ship can carry compared with an aircraft. It's quite fantastic. But when I say the lake was clear of ice, it's not clear. It's just broken up, and also in the field the ice is broken up. And the amazing thing is to see those pilots land in those planes. They skim along a few feet above the water, and as soon as they see a long clear bit, they drop the plane in, because if the ice hits the plane, rip the bottom out.
And does this lake have a name in print?
We called it Britannia Lake.
And that name stuck, did it?
Yeah. And the glacier alongside it, we called the Union Glacier. Unicorn, bless you.
So they were flying this stuff in, all of the stuff you were going to have.
Yep, kept flying.
And what was your wireless station doing?
The wireless station basically was just to communicate with, minimum, just to communicate with the aircraft flying to and from the lake, obviously. Once they got some stuff up to the lake, obviously, some of the main stuff was for the base hut, but Dixie set up another little station up there, and then I took over the radio station in the field, and Dixie was up there in the lake, so we could communicate back and forth, and also with the aircraft. Now, the Weasels hadn't gone on the Totten, because she came out. The Weasels went further up to, I think it's somewhere called Dove Boot or something like that. They were going to come. They had to travel the hard way up the Storstrom Glacier, which was a horrific glacier.
Now, what do you mean by weasels?
Track vehicles, the army, but with their trailers. They were going to come up further up and go right up the Storstrom Glacier and come round onto the ice cap.
But it's spelt like the animal. Spelt like the animal, the weasel.
Yeah, weasels, yeah. They're very old track vehicles. They had a horrendous journey because... this is where the ingenuity of these army boys came in. They'd had these trailers specially made out of aluminium, and they had rigid skis on them being towed by these weasels. And the Storstrom Glacier is quite a horrific glacier, a very, very long one.
How do you spell it? Do you know how you spell it?
Storstrom. S-T-O, with a couple of dots over it, I think. R, Stor. S-T-R-O-M-M-E-N, I think that's it. Storstrom and Glacier. And they got quite damaged and distorted, the trailer, because one of the slip-ups there was not having sprung skis on the trailers. And these army boys were making homemade rivets and firing rivet holes in the aluminium with a 2.2 rifle, shooting holes in and making their own rivets over the... Bunsen burner sort of thing.
Now, at this stage, so you were back at the fjord, and Dixie Dean was forward by the lake, Lake Britannia.
Yeah. And we carried on while they were completing those stores, and the Totten went back to, if I remember rightly, she went back and got more stores and came up again a second time. And there was constant flying, because, I mean, you've got 24 hours daylight. So, but the amazing thing was that what they had to watch, and it was quite remarkable, size there, these flying boats just take off and they'd be flying straight towards a mountain. You think, God, they're going to hit that. But it was miles and miles away. You know, so far, when you got in the flying boat itself, you didn't come nowhere near the mountain. It was so enormous, the size of the field and the size of the mountains. And what you had to watch, and the squadron leader used to stand by my hut when I was with the radio, and you'd say you'd be working the aircraft, all in Morse, and Dixie at the other end. And you'd suddenly see a mist coming up the field, and it would come up fast. And as soon as he saw that, the squadron leader would say, you know, tell him to get back quick, and don't do the normal circuit. He'd say, come straight in from the west, or come straight in from the east and land. You know, because these mists used to come up, and they come up very fast. It's quite amazing. But beautiful country, all the coasts around it. It must be very much like Norway.
And what were conditions like for you back at the field?
Oh, lovely.
You were living in a hut, I presume?
No, well, pardon me, in tents. In the tents, because the little hut had the radio in. And we've got tents, and so the tents up at the stream there. Yeah, for fresh water, you know, you get your water to drink. And then...
And what were living conditions like?
Quite pleasant, you know. Nothing out of the ordinary from camping, you know, sort of.
Not especially cold or anything?
No. It gets cold. Once you go onto the ice cap, the temperature drops about 50 degrees, just like that. Once you step on the ice cap, bang. And we're a long way from the ice cap in the field. Once all the stores was up, then the remainder of us who were left behind were flown up, and the Sunderlands had come home. But so one Sunderland, actually, in high winds up on the lake, had broken free from its mooring and went up on the shore and ripped a hole in the bottom, or a gash in the bottom. So they signalled back home to get some cement sent up, because you had a rivalry between, later on, the Hastings aircraft of Transport Command, which was doing the airdrops and the ice cap, and the Sunderlands of Coastal Command, and you get the old rivalry, and the Sunderlands weren't going to say they lost an aircraft, so they filled it with concrete, you know, in the bottom where the crack was to get her. Mind you, she was a write-off when she got back, but they got her home, sort of thing.
So what happened when you got out there to Lake Britannia?
One of the things that happened, unfortunately, was one of the, because they made their own rafts, and because we had two and a half kilowatt Petter diesel engines to supply 230 volts AC in the base hut, and one mainly for, the idea being for, normal lighting and that sort of thing, and the other one for scientific, the lab and the scientific work. And one of the rafts capsized, and we lost one engine to the bottom of the lake, and lots of other stuff. An AVO test meter was still in its packing, tropical packing, which was, and it was blown across the far side lake. It had enough air to float, and was battered on the rocks sometime they found it, and. Dixie Dean evidently had taken it out of its case and hung it up in the top of the tent over a primer stove and dried it out. And we used it all through the expedition. And when we came back, AVO's tested it, and it's still within the required accuracy. It was a good advert for their instruments.
Now, what was the sort of camp you were setting up? What was the nature of it? Just tents?
Oh, no. The base hut was quite large.
Can you describe it? Did it have a name as a base?
No, just a base camp. it was a prefabricated building, Canadian, sort of plywood in layers with insulation materials. The windows were triple glazed, and put it on a concrete base. You know, sort of. This is why you've got a Royal Engineer, Captain Royal Engineers. You see, because they had to set up the diesel engine as well on a base and everything else. The design of the thing was, one side was laboratory, so that was rectangular in shape. Then you had at right angles to add a piece, and then at right angles that you had another piece. So it was like, how would you say the shape? Like a letter H with top right arm and the bottom left arm missing. So like an L with a bit down. Now the idea of that is, the piece in the middle was not insulated. I was like, there was nothing in there, so the instruments had been out in the cold. You could bring back and put it in there, so you wouldn't get condensation on them when you took them out again. Also, if you had a fire in, say, the lab side, because in the one side was and the laboratory and the radio room, and the other side had the galley and the dining room. And the bit that sort of where we had our bunks, where we slept. So if either of those sides had burnt, it wouldn't go to the other side because you had this bit in the middle. It came in handy actually, because when some of the huskies were having pups, we could bring them in out and put them in there. It wasn't hot for them, but at the same time they were protected from the bad weather. We put them in a box in there. And now I was on the party going to the ice cap. This party consisted of six of us. Jim Simpson, the leader, Richard Hamilton, the chief scientist, and me with one sledge. Who was it? Angus Erskine, Peter Taylor. Angus Erskine was in charge of dogs anyway, sort of overall. Peter Taylor, glaciologist. What's the other one? Oh dear.
Now
there were six of us. I'm just trying. I can look.
That's
that up
five of them anyway. Yeah. Now, what you've not mentioned the sledges or dogs at all, really, yet. What was the system? What types of sledges? How many dogs? Who? What was the whole thing?
Oh well, I mean, they were all unloaded because the Tottenham picked those up. The dogs and the sledge. Two types of sledge. The Nansen sledge, which is one you use on snow.
What were they like?
Oh, excellent. I mean, they...
What they looked like, though? How big?
Well, each sledge was carrying 1,200 pounds in weight. I know that. So the Nansen sledge has got flat runners. You use on snow. That was what we take on the ice cap.
That's what the ice cap party had. Right?
Yeah, yeah. And the other sledge, the I just mentioned the name, didn't I? Greenland sledges. They go on rough ice, and you know, on the coast and that sort of thing. They're very crude sledges, really. But they're hardy for the Nansen sledges. Are all kept together by rawhide, tying the joints and everything else, so they give them bend and weave to a certain degree. On the runners we had like a plastic base, make them slide better.
And what about the dogs?
We had three sledge teams, 12 dogs to a team. When I say three sledge team, each sledge towed a sledge, so we had six sledges basically. Did they? Oh no!
I thought you said there were two sledges in there.
I can't remember now whether we were. Can you switch off and I'll look at the book?
There's no point. No point. They can look in the book themselves. It's what you remember.
No. Anyway, there was 12 dogs to a sledge. Now, Jim Simpson, the leader, and myself were on one sledge.
You've done that, yeah. What about the dogs? Who looked after them? What were they like?
Well, we looked after your own dogs. Looked after your own dogs. You had the food for the dogs. Live on pemmican, which is like a big oxo cube. It's just like a. I mean, in the base, they use hellefisk, which is, I think, Danish for halibut, but it's dried and it's in big barrels, and they used to feed them on that. But when you're sledging, you've got these large blocks of pemmican. We ate pemmican, but not the same sort as the dogs. Theirs was made of more offal and that sort of thing.
What were the dogs like? Were they friendly dogs or were they
pretty... Oh, they're friendly to humans. They fight like hell amongst themselves. I mean, they're in separate families, so you kept them apart. And you had to have one bitch with each team. Because it's an amazing thing that if they've got a bitch that lifts the spirit of the dogs, they're more... Because they all think she's mine. 11 dogs all think they own her. And on the back of the sledge, you had a compass, like a ship's boat compass. And the thing was, there were three sledges. That was about two on each sledge, because there were six in the party. And I'm just trying to think. Gosh.
It shouldn't have...
Graham Rollitt, of course he was the meteorologist. So there was six of us, that was it.
So two on each sledge?
Two on each sledge.
And you travel on the sledge?
No, no. No way. All this business, you see these people in Canada charge along, stand in the back and say, no, you tramp alongside on skis. It's hard graft.
Now, tell me about the skis.
Just normal skis.
Now, when did you learn to ski?
There. And you're not skiing, you're walking. I mean, I have no interest in skiing as such, because if you've walked hundreds of miles on skis, I can see no fun in it at all.
So it's just a matter of walking.
Walking. You have to learn the right type of walk. It's like sliding your feet. But, I mean, you're going along either side of the sledge. About,
did you have poles to help you along?
Yeah, you had ski sticks. But Jim's, one would have the whip, long whip. Now, you never hit the dogs with the whip. I mean, the command there for go was Dammer. Dammer. And then I think Uli, you say, was go left or right. And you used to flick the whip. If you wanted them to go left, you flick the whip to the right of the right-hand dog. The dogs were in fan shape, not like in Canada where they run one behind the other. Because they do that in Canada because of all the trees. There's no trees on the ice cap, so they're in a fan shape. And you flick the snow either side of the dogs up the front, so they veer over then, away from the whip. Unit, I think, was stop.
So you'd shout this, but at the same time you'd flick the whip.
Yeah. Now, Richard Hamilton, who'd done expeditions before, he said the secret is you've got to keep talking to the dogs, and you talk in a high-pitched voice. And it was wonderful to see. All the dogs have got names, and Richard would be going along, good boy, it's good boy, keep going, lovely, good boy. And he'd mention their names all the time, good boy, keep going. And I always remember once he said, you neat, and because the dogs love pulling. They do love pulling. And they'd stop, and he was going, you neat, you neat, you neat. And all of a sudden he lost his temper, he's whipping everywhere, you neat, you neat, you neat. The voice dropped and he lost his temper. But, and also, what you have to do is, when you've got this sort of overcast sky and you've got the snow on the ice cap, so you've got no horizon. It's just like being inside a ping pong ball. There's nothing to put your eyes on, and you can go funny. And what we used to have to do, it does for the dogs as well. One had to go in front and lead, so the dogs had something to look at. So you'd be in front on your own. And this is where it's an amazing thing you learn. You know when people say they got lost and they went round in circles? Everybody goes round in circles. They're not all the same. some people always go to the left, some people always go to the right. But if you've got nothing to look at, you will find that you will go around in a circle. So what you did, you've got these sledges behind you and you're up in front and you'd be leading off, you see. And every time you look around, and the man on the back sledge, right at the very back, with his ski stick, would do that or that, because you were... I tended to always go to the right. Keep you, the first part...
So it was the compass, that the man on the sledge was using the compass to direct
you. Now, when you think about it, where you are up there, I mean, here in the UK, a deviation on a compass is about 7 degrees west, isn't it? Something like that. You know, in other words, it points to the magnetic north and not the true north. You imagine getting up a couple of hundred, not 200 or 300 miles from the North Pole, magnetic north. So you've got a deviation that's 70 degrees, 75 degrees, 80 degrees, depending where you are. Terrific deviation. So you can't follow the compass needle because it's going to North Canada.
So how do you do it? I mean,
well, you've got to allow for that deviation, because I mean, you've got it on charts. You see the deviation here. I think in the UK, I mean, it varies. It's roughly about 70 degrees west, I think. Now, used to change over, obviously, because you're in front as well. You've got nothing to look at. Now, another amazing thing when you're sledging, the snow on the surface of the ice cap is quite hard. It's crusty where the wind's packed it down. But there's an air gap under that, a small air gap. And as the weight of you lot coming along, all of a sudden, for perhaps a square mile, you'll hear a whoom as the whole surface drops a few inches. It's quite remarkable. You suddenly hear this whoom. And of course, you have to be wary while you wear the skis, is because of crevasses, because they get covered over. And you're in uncharted ground, you don't know where the crevasses are. They get covered over, and you could get a bridge of packed snow. And when you step on that, you could fall through. Having the ski on, it distributes your weight better. We got to one part where we were sledging, where